We sometimes use the expression, I remember it well. And Daniel, who perhaps quite late on in his life, came to write this book, reflects under the Holy Spirit, as always, on the events of his early life. And he remembers well that he purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's meat. Now, to have a purpose and an aim, both long-term and short-term, of course, is a great and an important thing in life. And in Daniel's particular circumstances, it was most especially important that he should, because as we saw last time, that he was probably only 12 or 13 at the time that this happened, and that he was removed from home and from parents and was with those of his own age. And for the short term, he could have been very unhappy and very bitter. And as for the long term, well, he could have become cynical and he could have become thoroughly embroiled in the life of the world. But at that age, he purposed in his heart that things would not be like that. Clearly, this was something that was the gift of God. But at the same time, it does remind both ourselves of the importance of purposing the things of God in our heart, and also that young children can, from the earliest of years, be thus convicted and thus move and motivated in their heart. So it is that Daniel records that he purposed that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's meat. Now, it would appear from the way the whole chapter reads that he looks back with affection and gratitude to God that these things had been so. I mean, he is writing possibly 70 years on from these things, and possibly even more. And therefore, it is something that he sees as being at the root of all the good things into which the Lord later led him. The consummate prophecies that come after much testing and tempting that were revealed to him as a man greatly beloved. But how did the Lord first show that he was to be a man greatly beloved? Well, inasmuch as whether a boy of that age understood that as such, he was a boy greatly beloved, and it showed by being allowed to be separated from the majority of the others of the own age in his thinking towards God. And if we want to observe what is going to make somebody outstanding in the things of God in a generation to come, well, you look in youth for someone who is not taken up with all the things of the world, but who shows a steady and a keen fixing on the things of the Lord Jesus Christ from early conversion days. That is not to say that those who do otherwise will not go along and not witness a good confession and not be accepted in the beloved. But we're thinking here of exception. We're thinking here of leadership in a generation. We're thinking here of leadership in days that are difficult. And in Daniel's case, being ranked alongside Job and alongside Noah, that is to say that the excellence, the standard of excellence which God enabled him to have, would stand the test of any generation. But this is what you look for, and if you see it, the heart leaps for joy. That he purposed in his heart not to defile himself with the portion of the king's meat. It's difficult for us to know, perhaps, exactly where he thought the danger of defilement was coming from. It is unlikely that it would have come from the nature of the things that he would eat. Maybe asked to eat pork, maybe in the way it was cooked, you wouldn't know it was pork. We later find him in chapter 10, for example, drinking wine. So it does not seem to lie particularly in the Jewish audiences. One commentator says, surely on the journey there he would not have been able not to have had some other food that would not be part of the Jewish taste and would not be defiled according to Jewish laws. And anyway, as a believer, he would know that defilement really was in the heart and not in these things. That to the pure all things are pure. And therefore it is probably right that what the Lord enabled Daniel to spot and to feel was not just the outward disposition of what he was eating, but where it would lead. And of course, if he was able at that young age to spot where a thing would lead, then that is a great gift of God. I have known one or two ministers who immediately you talk about something or some new doctrine is mentioned, will know immediately where in 100 years' time the thing will lead. I don't see things like that. I don't have that sort of gift at all. But it looks as if Daniel, under the guidance of God, had this. And the two things that seem to be crucial was that, one, he was to be exposed to the court and to the teaching and to everything that had to do with Chaldea and to do with the people of Nebuchadnezzar, the Chaldean Empire. And he, while he was willing, had no option, and clearly was willing to learn their language and to learn their customs, even as Moses did, yet he was unwilling that by the means of accepting the king's portion, that he should be drawn away from his own land and its culture. But, of course, we're not thinking of the land, nor are we thinking of the culture. We're thinking of God. We're thinking of I am that I am. And it would seem that what Daniel felt that the defilement would tend to, a reliance on the king rather than on the Lord. And, of course, if you are in hock to people, then maybe you can't insist on your own standards. And therefore he wanted to be sure that his fellowship with the Lord God was absolutely primary in his experience. And he felt that that was compromised by the whole matter of the provision of the king's bounty. The king's bounty was indeed bountiful. There would be dainties, there would be things that an ordinary boy in his position, even though he might have been of a royal family, well, he was of some, a minor royal at least, the very least. But even there, he would have probably not experienced in that land the sort of things that were available to Nebuchadnezzar. And the other thing that maybe he was aware of, it's quite amazing that when young people get together, and if the young Jewish boys who had been brought all that way were by this time mixing or beginning to mix to some extent with the ones also from Chaldea and perhaps from other parts of the kingdom, and maybe even mixing with the ones who were 2 years into their course, he might have noticed that the being involved in all the luxuries of the king's court led to the sort of depravity that is common in king's courts. Led to the sort of impurities that they wanted no part of in the name of their lord. And that the decadence that was involved in these things might have ruined his soul, dragged him down. There seems to have been something of those two things in particular, rather than the actual fact that it was wine and the fact that there would perhaps have been some pork and so on among the food. It seems to be that these were the great issues that brought him to purpose these things. He wanted to keep his heart and mind to worship Jehovah as his only king, and he wanted to do it in purity and in love and in wholesomeness. So Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's meat nor the wine which he drank. Now, we see by verse 11 that the other three are involved with him in this. It is a good thing to have fellowship with other believers of like mind and of our own age, if that's how we're thrown together. And if someone has a strong influence, to exercise that influence. It would seem to me that Hananiah, Mishael and Azariah were very willing to follow his lead. Whether they would have done so if there'd been no Daniel is another matter. But clearly the influence of this one young lad was powerful upon those other three, if not on any of the others. And it is a good thing to remember that we are able to have an influence within our family for good, for godliness, for holiness, for purity. And we are able to have an influence on those of our own age, if we're at college or if we're at work or whatever, but that we do have an influence. And that our removal from the scene might cause things to decline, and we then would realise the effect that perhaps we had and we didn't realise we had. I remember that all the time that I was at Aubra all those years ago, in those days the churches stood fast in the fraternal. We all did meet in fraternal in those days, the Methodist minister and a couple of Baptist ministers, the Leicester one and ourselves and the vicars. But we would not let the Roman Catholics in. The minute I'd gone, it happened. So there is an influence that we have that may be for good, and we may not realise that we're exercising it at the time. We just do the things that we think are right. But vanish from the scene and the decadence may set in, or the lowering of standards may set in, or whatever it is. And it seems, therefore, that Daniel had this tremendous effect under the Lord over these other three. Now, we do incidentally, during the book of Daniel, see something of the lives of these other three. It would appear that they were, if in their own right, or they became in their own right, advisors and probably not politicians so much as executives of the government. Possibly their ways went different ways. One would have got appointed to a post in one part and another to a post in another, perhaps of equal standing and so on. But they would be separate for much of their time. But they had this time together, and from time to time their lives came together again. And that's good to see people of your own generation whom you've shared good things with, and you spend your lives doing the same ministry. You don't see them very often, but you know they're ministering like you're ministering or whatever. And then just occasionally you meet up again. And so as Daniel had made this purpose, he went to the prince of the eunuchs and requested that he should not defile himself with the king's meat. Now, notice first of all that he probably did this prayerfully. He doesn't say that here. But he was showed his wisdom, even at that young age, in the approach that he made to the prince of the eunuchs. Now, the prince of the eunuch had the ear of the king. The prince of the eunuch was a high-up court dignitary. And therefore, this was a very brave thing for him to do. And if he had come over in any way surly, grumpy, rude, it certainly would have put the back up of this man. But we're told that God had brought Daniel into favour and tender love with the prince of the eunuchs. One of the commentators makes the remark, if any bad man has any good intentions towards one of God's people, it has to be God's doing. And so, as it says here, God had brought Daniel. Now, God was working in Daniel's heart and preparing Daniel for a long and powerful ministry that would be culminated in these prophecies down the years, but also be greatly used in his own times and in his own generation. And in order to do that, God himself, independently of anything that Daniel possessed within him, had brought him. Obviously, this man looked at him and could see characteristics that he admired, that he respected, that he thought highly of. And therefore, this favour that he had towards him, and this compassion, we don't know what he felt. He was a hardened man, but on the other hand, he might have seen so many young people. And he sees that these are brought as captives, whereas many of the others who were there, the Chaldeans, weren't captives. They were just being trained up and thought themselves honoured to be done so. But whatever the reason, however the Lord had done it, he brought Daniel into favour with the prince of the eunuchs. Now, the favour lay in this. Now, Daniel was brave, but just supposing the opposite. If he had gone to this man and said, I do not wish to defile myself with the provision of Nebuchadnezzar, and if this man had been hostile to him and gone to Nebuchadnezzar and said, one of these men that you have brought from Israel, since he's defiled when he touches your food, well, he'd had his head chopped off. That's what Daniel would have done. So it was a very important provision of the Lord that this man did regard Daniel with some favour. Whatever nature it was, there's no impurity about it, but whatever it was, whether he just respected him, whether he saw him, whether he had talked with him from time to time and liked what he saw, whether he could see in him a man who would rise to, had the capability of rising to where he was, but not usurping him. However, whatever it was, the Lord put it so that he was not averse to the conversation of Daniel when he ventured on bold things. Now, sometimes it is a good thing for us to remember these things. If we do have issues to face, and we largely, I suppose, face the issues today by sending off to the Christian Institute or writing letters to MPs or whatever we do, but you see, here we have principles that one can do it very courteously. But we must remember that the Lord has a favour to his people. And that it only needs one person in one place to be able to bring to pass all the purposes of God. Now, we might write to our MP, let's say, I'm only joking about this in the sense that our MPs are different and I don't know. But our MP might rebuff us, but he puts the letters on file. But there might be someone higher up in the cabinet or someone who actually espouses this issue. And if he is the one that will have the principal argument with the secretaries and with the Prime Minister and so on. I've not gone into it in a great detail, but you can see how it might work, you see. And what we have to believe is that if we're about God's business and the Lord's way, we must do things courteously, but the Lord will be moving someone with influence somewhere if he desires to forward his purposes. Now, I remember seeing at the time when Danny was among us, because he used to like looking at all the websites about the AV and so on. But when you saw the vitriolic things that supposed Christians wrote about supposed Christians who held opposite views, The whole of this is denied. Courtesy. What courtesy? If you don't hold the AV, you may fling vitriol at them. And no doubt it was returned to it by those who were not wise. But you see here, wisdom says courteousness, care, patience, prayer. All lies in these things. Now, with those things in mind, we ask ourselves what we make under the influence of the Spirit of verse 10. And the prince of the eunuchs said unto Daniel, I fear my lord the king, who hath appointed your meat and your drink. For why should he see your faces worse liking than the children which are of your sort? Then shall he make me endanger my head to the king. But Daniel immediately, well, the next stage in the story, goes to Meltzer and repeats this particular issue. Now, how could he have done that honestly without being underhand? And the answer seems to lie in the manner of the reply of this man. The prince of the eunuchs said to Daniel, I fear my lord the king. He is immediately over me. He's not my line manager, they didn't have such things then, but he is the one to whom I'm responsible, and actually my immediate responsibility is to the very top man. There is no way that I can connive at anything contrary to what he has ruled. No. We know from the New Testament, if you like, that free to preach, whether in the sight of God, should we obey God, obey man rather than God? But here is the man appointed by the Lord, the king of gold, as it were, one of the most powerful and probably the best kings that has ever lived in terms of his power and so on. I fear my lord the king, who hath appointed your meat and your drink. And the reason is, why should he see your faces worse liking than the children which are of your sort? He is going to see if you look pale. He is going to see if you become sickly. He is going to see if you're not up to weight. He is going to see all these things. You are sufficiently in his into his presence, and I don't think they at all amused together, but it would appear that occasionally, certainly, he would be aware of them. And obviously Nebuchadnezzar was very astute and took an interest in these particular things, and he says, it'll be off with my head if I in any way connive with this. And what seems to come across is that he gave the impression that he would turn a blind eye. He didn't want to be specifically told that it was happening. He didn't want to know if it was happening. But the indication simply was not an outright refusal, and certainly not that he would tell the king in high dudgeon. But if we are to say that Daniel here acted under the power of the Spirit, and the Spirit always works in purity and love, we're to say here that this man clearly gave the impression to Daniel that he wouldn't take any notice as long as things worked out all right, but that he didn't really want to know about it. So Daniel then proceeds to maybe the teacher. It may be that perhaps a dozen of them or two dozen of them had one particular teacher. Two dozen would make a lot of sense, wouldn't it? Clearly there was enough to be able to compare these four with another four or five or more. So Meltzer may have been one of a number of those who had been steward, but maybe one of a number of teachers or those who were responsible for being their tutors. Maybe tutor would be a good definition of the task here of Meltzer. Anyway, he turns to this man who was the next down the list. The prince of the eunuchs has set this man over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah, among others, I think, because of the comparison that follows. And he says to him, prove thy servants, now involving the four of them, prove thy servants, I beseech thee, 10 days. Now, what strikes me, I don't know if there's anything in it particularly, had the prince of the eunuchs acceded to the request, it would only have involved Daniel. Because he only asked for himself. And they couldn't then take a liberty and get the others doing it. He does only ask for himself. But now he's going down the line, he asks for the others too, and gets it. So the spirit has been moving here to achieve a greater end than maybe we would have thought possible. And it's a reversal of what you might have thought. We would sometimes say, well, I'm going to go to the top. I'll get something done that way. In fact, in this particular case, something gets done by not going to the top. Prove thy servants, he says, servants, you see, I beseech thee 10 days. So he actually comes up with a plan, which again, he didn't dare to put before, I imagine. You don't really tell the governor what to do. But he was able to suggest to this man a plan of action. And you see here, both the wisdom of his approach and his courtesy, and the wisdom of his strategy. And the wisdom of the particular plan that he uses to prove it. You can see all the traits that had been observed. These were to be, verse 4, children in whom there was no blemish, but well-favoured and skilful in all wisdom and cunning in knowledge. Not that I think that cunning has its full English expression there, but you can see something of his ability to outwit and outthink some others. Prove thy servants, I beseech thee, 10 days. Let them give us pulse to eat and water to drink. Well, by pulse, the word means things that are planted, seeds, peas and that sort of thing. Couscous, anything of that sort, obviously. Pearl barley, whatever you like. But that sort of thing. I don't know that there's any deliberate intent to say that it was vegetarian, but I think in essence it would have been. But I don't think for that reason. This was just simple things. Now, whether this would sufficiently have sustained them unless the Lord was in this, and he knew that the Lord was going to bless him in this way, and that they would flourish on this food, one thinks that by nature perhaps they wouldn't have done, but simply that the Lord put it into his head and honoured his stand and made this thing to be true. Then let our countenances be looked upon before thee, the countenance of the children that eat the portion of the king's meat. So you can compare them. And that's why I'm saying I think Meltzar had not only those four, but a few others. And as thou seest, deal with thy servants. So he consented to them in this matter. The end of 10 days, their countenances appeared fairer and fatter in flesh than all the children which did eat the portion of the king's meat. Thus Meltzar took away the portion of their meat. Now, the commentators mostly leap upon this, that Meltzar took it away. And they suggest that Meltzar himself could see the personal advantage he would get out of this. That the thing was not to be... I don't know how well known this thing would have been. You see, if there were others who could see them eating only this, the word could have got around rapidly, but the Lord obviously prevented that. But what you see would happen, and the commentators say Meltzer had an interest in this, here was the portion of meat 3 times a day for 4 people that was now going to be diverted to his family for 3 years. You see? So they liked the commentators on these words. He took it away. But he had an interest in taking it away. I don't know whether that's right or not. But it would seem to have disappeared. It would seem that it would not have been possible for it not to have been taken. Otherwise Nebuchadnezzar would have spotted it. So anyway, Meltzar took away the portion of their meat and the wine that they should drink and gave them pulse. Now, as for these 4 children, God gave them knowledge. Now, would you just at this point look at verse 4? Now, the king had spoken unto Ashpenaz, the master of the eunuchs, that he should bring certain of the children of Israel and of the king's seed and of the princes, children in whom was no blemish, but well favoured, skillful in all wisdom, cunning in knowledge, and understanding science, and such as had ability, we would perhaps say potential, in them to stand in the king's palace, and whom they might teach the learning and tongue of the Chaldeans. Now, these, if you like, were out of the top drawer. These were the cream of the cream. By nature. And saved individuals, as doubtless they were, they would have had the increase of the Spirit upon them. But what is mentioned here in verse 17 is now the extra attainments on top of these. You have these skills when you go to university, you have these skills when you attack A-levels, but there's much to learn and achieve in the time you're doing A-levels or you're getting your degrees, do you see? And what is being spoken about in this verse is the extra things that they've got on top of that basis of a natural understanding, knowledge, and so on. And this we received was God-given. God directed their learning and their understanding. Now, of course, we know that God confounded the languages of Babel, and therefore he is familiar with every language that there's ever been. It is no difficulty to the Lord to help someone to master another language and its expression. And God gave them knowledge and skill in all learning and wisdom, the learning and tongue of the Chaldeans, but particularly orientated in the two directions, I would suggest to you. Directions to be able to read their old books of the stars and all these things, where he might have come across the prophecies of Balaam. And also to do the political administration. So the terminology of the court, the terminology of the marketplace, the terminology of administration is one aspect. And the ancient reading of their great books of the past and their histories, another aspect. Probably, the study of astronomy and of mathematics would have figured very strongly in this particular thing. This is where the Magi came from, after all. And possibly the astrology. Now, some of the interpreters say, well, Daniel wouldn't have allowed himself, as a matter of purity, to have got involved in astrology. That is the science of believing that the stars direct individual people's lives according to when they were born. And that is a science falsely so called, no doubt. But he might have been required to have been open to it to see its falsity. We don't know, but it was part and parcel of what's there. But the Lord gave them knowledge and skill. In all learning, all sorts of learning and wisdom. Whatever it was needed, he had. And in addition, Daniel, but not the others, Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. Now, it probably means, for the most part, other people's visions and dreams, like it was going to be Nebuchadnezzar and so on, rather than his own, probably. But when you read the interpretations of visions and dreams in the Old Testament, Joseph and others down the years, and you read the interpretations, it all sounds very straightforward, but you would never have thought these things yourself unless it had been pointed out to you. And it would seem that what is meant here is that the Lord gave Daniel the specific clues of all visions and dreams as and when they occurred. Not that he had a set of principles and he knew how to apply them all, but that the Lord blessed him with that skill, like a doctor might have skill in seeing what a particular thing is that other doctors don't all have. But he was given this directly by God. And visions, obviously, and dreams formed a very important part in the lives of the ancient people, as they did in Joseph's time and here. So this was something additional. And it's mentioned especially because it's going to be relevant to what we get. And then at the end of the days, the prince of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar. Now, this is a very formidable examination. you're going to be brought before the king, the greatest king of the greatest kingdom, who clearly has a great understanding himself. In addition to being a top general, he had been for 20 years before this the principal general of his father, Nabonidus, and he had taken Jerusalem. And you have to be astute in mathematics, the logistics of an army. You have to be astute in mathematics to calculate how the catapult brings down the walls. There are all sorts of skills involved, but here was a man who was on top of his job. He knew how to rule and run all the civilians from a vast area and was general of his army. Until recently, he had only just become king. And now he's going to examine these lads, see what progress they've made. He knows that they started as being without blemish, well-favoured, skillful, cunning in knowledge, understanding science. Now he wants to see what they've learned in the things he's interested in. And that is formidable. I think our children, who have 3 hours exams, have nothing compared with this. I reckon that though the word is used, communed with them, I'm not sure that it was altogether. Now, if you get a moment when you get home to read about the visit of the Queen of Sheba in 1 Kings, let's suggest we look at it now. But not only does it give us a little bit of interest about the meaning to stand before the king, where that expression is also used, but she communed with King Solomon all that was in her heart and asked him many hard questions. Now, of course, that wasn't under examination conditions. But what you can see probably happening here is something like speaking in the Chaldean language. He would ask them probably how they would handle this situation, how they would handle that situation. He'd be aware of how they'd handled some of their internal situations and so on. But he would be talking about all sorts of things, covering all the range of subjects. And he might ask them, as I say, what they might do in certain political situations that he might want to send them to in days to come. And so this was a very exacting examination. It wasn't just for the four of them. It looks as if the king, over a period of 3 or 4 weeks, spent his time in examining these young people. Oh, anyway, the king communed with them, and among them all was found none like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And they stood before the king. The significance of this doesn't seem to be they stood in the examination room. You've got this expression also in verse 5, and as I say, it comes in 1 Kings 10, which is the story of the Queen of Sheba. It seems to mean that they now will be serving the king almost immediately under his command, under his direction. They'll be in his personal private secretary, so to speak. You know, they'll be under his immediate care. And in all matters of wisdom and understanding that the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better than all magicians. Now, and Daniel continued even unto the first year of King Cyrus. Now, that was 70 years away. The only thing I'm asking you is not to misinterpret that. He did continue unto the first year of the king of Cyrus, and it's important to mention it here, because what it's saying is this situation that he began to take up didn't cease for 70 years. I mean, he probably got promotions and all sorts of things, but this actual standing before the monarch didn't cease till Cyrus came. But there's no implication that it ended then, because we know 3 years afterwards he was still serving the new king. So you mustn't assume that it just went on till then and then ceased. It didn't. It continued after that. And then we read in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, and I just wanted to deal with that. But the problem is, you see, that he was 3 years on his course. And probably the best way, there are various suggestions, and nobody really knows for sure, but it looks as if the best suggestion is this, that it was Nebuchadnezzar, as his father's general, that took Jerusalem, And it was Nebuchadnezzar who commanded the young people to be brought into service while he was still second in command. In the middle of all that, he was appointed sole king, his father either dying or ceasing to, or made the kingdom over to him. And therefore, that midway or partway through this course, he became the sole monarch. And therefore, it was the second year of his reign, perhaps a year after the events when they had their examination or something like that. There are other possible interpretations. For example, you know that in the calculating in the old days, 3 years might mean hardly more than two, because if it was the very end of let's say BC 600, and it incurred the whole of 601 and only just the 599, and then the beginning of 598. That would only be 15 months, but it would count as 3 years, because each of those 3 years was involved, and that's how they counted. That might also explain how it was that it was in the second year of his reign, if he'd been reigning all that time. I think myself that the best explanation is that it was while they were there that he became the sole monarch. And always scripture things do yield to things, but we don't always know all the facts. But I just wanted to clear that now, because there's a lot to consider in the next chapter, and we wouldn't want to spend time on doing that then. Oh, thank you.